Good morning. Hi. So this morning, can you hear me, Arnie? Good. Okay. So this morning, I'm going to talk about a case in the Blue Cliff Records. I was talking about cases in the Blue Cliff Records during the retreat that we finished last Sunday. So this is a case I didn't talk about that is sort of a sequel to one of the cases I did talk about. And it's an interchange with Zhao Zhou. And I did talk about Zhao Zhou quite a bit during the retreat and also, I think, last Sunday. I'm not sure. So Zhao Zhou, just to remind folks, or to educate if you don't know, lived in the 9th century in China. He started practice when he was a teen. He supposedly practiced until he was 119, at which point he died. He didn't start teaching until he was 60, same age that I, he got a temple at 60, same age as me. Oh, 119. Wow. What else about him? He appears a lot in these records of interchanges in the ninth century, and he's thought of as a lips and mouth teacher because he didn't beat people or poke them or even yell at them. Which was, if you read the Chinese stories, it's a little bit of an oddity. Because there was a lot of poking and beating and yelling going on. And he was a very simple person. I could tell more about him, but then that would take the whole talk. And those of you who were in retreat with me, you heard me talk about him already. I did speak, I think, last time about when he had his first opening, his first awakening, and supposedly he was in his late teens, and he said, "Suddenly I was ruined and homeless." Boy, that sounds like a great opening, doesn't it? You know, there's this the way in which the Chinese use these terms. It's meant to convey spaciousness and beauty, but. On surface, it sounds not the case. His lineage died, so it hasn't been maintained, even though he had a lot of students. So his initial opening, "Suddenly I was ruined and homeless," He doesn't talk too much about that, except he says it was inspirational for him, that it really propelled him to practice for the next 40 years. And when we do meditation daily and we do retreats, we're counting on at times sinking into a quietness that will propel us to continue. If we don't have any trace of that, and we sit, we just want to give this up, go do something else. So those experiences of encouragement come on their own when we're really applying ourselves to the meditation. And during the retreat, I was talking about using the metaphor of the chatterbox cafe. In a way, when Zhao Zhou was suddenly ruined and homeless, he somehow left his home in the Chatterbox Cafe. He just was ruined. He no longer had it as his home anymore. So he had the freedom of the sky, of the earth, of the water, because he wasn't stuck there anymore. And he was a very simple guy. He didn't dress ornately. He just supposedly had one robe. And his students wanted to turn the temple, his temple, his practice center, into a great, beautiful, elegant temple. But he said no, he didn't want them doing that kind of fundraising. He just wanted them to practice. But he did attract a lot of people, and they did have to raise money just to put the people up to practice. We're a little bit in a similar situation. We had 30 people here for our retreat, and if we'd had any more, I'm not sure where we would have put them. Maybe on the stairs. So that's why we're not trying to raise money to improve our porch, so that we can have people when we have retreat who sit on the porch. And it's right now it's pretty cold out there, pretty drafty, especially in the winter. So now the case itself, case 58. A monk asked Zhaozhou, "The great way has no difficulties, just avoid picking and choosing. Isn't this a cliche for people of these times?" Zhaozhou said, "Once someone asked me that, and it's been 5 years and I still don't know." Well, at three times in the Blue Cliff Records, at least three times, Zhaozhou quotes this. He quotes this saying from Sangsan, from the third ancestor Sangsan. And during Sesshin, I talked about this case number two, in which he quotes it. So the student's kind of saying to him, "You know, didn't you say this already? Didn't you say this 5 years ago and the beginning of the Blue Cliff Records, and didn't you say it again? And isn't this kind of a cliche, teacher?" Kind of an impertinent student by Chinese standards, not by American standards, but by Chinese standards. And Zhaozhou repeats, "Once someone asked me this, and it's been 5 years, and I still don't know." And the student says, "Isn't this a cliche for people of these times?" So these times, 9th century, were hard times for Zen people. Zen had not entered yet the establishment phase. It was still struggling to get recognized. And the Confucians were persecuting the Buddhists. And so in these times, teacher, are these words that you say over and over again, are they really helpful? I mean, don't we need something more when times are hard to encourage us? So in religion, we have a lot of truisms, a lot of things that get repeated over and over again in any religion. And when are they helpful to us? And when are they just cliches? When are they just superficial? My mother was a Catholic, an Irish Catholic, stayed Irish but got rid of Catholic. But she dropped out in college. She dropped out of Catholic Church in college, and I asked her that about that once, and she said, "Oh, all those stuff they repeated to us all the time." She said it was just trite. It was just cliches. It was just covering up stuff. And this was during the Depression. And she said they were either saying to us, "Oh, it's all God's will, dear. It's all God's will," when everybody was suffering, and it didn't seem to me like it was just God was doing this, or the other hand, they were saying, "Oh, you're all sinners, dear. You're all sinners." So that was her reaction, and she left the church. And Suzuki Roshi left Japan because he felt that people were just spouting a bunch of Zen stuff, but they weren't really living it. They weren't really going within. And it was just becoming kind of a hollow truism. So I think we need to be careful of that, especially in Zen, but really in any religion, in any quest to uncover our stillness and to go outside, be free from our incessant chattering. So in a way, I don't know what's going to happen in this country. Nobody seems to. But are we going into another depression, a depression like my mom's in the 30s? We don't know. We don't know. And then is a depression, maybe it's just going to be a recession. Maybe it's just going to be like this. Is a depression a good time or a bad time to practice? Does it make any difference? In a way, when I read about what this depression is going to be like, this recession is already like, mostly good stuff for Zen practice. I hate to say that, but it's mostly good stuff. Less time doing consumerism, less time buying, less vehicles, more staying at home. More walking, more biking was all good Zen stuff, right? So, more unemployment. Now, that's too bad, but I can't say that's bad Zen stuff. You guys will have more time to sit. You don't have any time. You have no time to sit now. You work 40, 50, 60, 70 hours a week. Maybe if you only work 20 or 25 hours a week, you could sit. Of course, you have to have food, but I don't think this depression anybody is going to... Well, maybe I hope not. Well, none of you guys will starve anyway. So it's interesting. It's interesting. The one thing that I read when I was reading this article on depressions was that I thought, well, this won't help Zen practices. The amount of TV watching goes up exponentially. So... But other than that, and if you instead of turning your mind to the TV and your body to the TV, you just turn it to face the wall, just come here and sit with me, sit with us. Hey. So back to the case. A monk asks Zhao Shuo, "The great way has no difficulties, just avoid picking and choosing. Isn't this a cliche for people of these times?" Zhao Shuo said, "Once someone asked me, and it's been 5 years and I still don't know." So, in cliche, in Chinese... In Chinese, cliché means nest or den, where you burrow and make a home. So that's pretty good, huh? It's a nest or a den where we burrow and make a home. Chatterbox Cafe. You say it over and over and over again till it's just sort of a dull state of mind. A dull, not even an alive hypnotic state of mind, just sort of a dull state of mind. And the third line of the saying that he's quoting from Sung San, from the who's the third ancestor, is stop talking and thinking. There is nothing that you will not be able to know. So that's the third line, and I talked about this during retreat too. So the way has no difficulties, just avoid picking and choosing. Well, of course the way has difficulties. But the avoiding picking and choosing comes from the practice, from the practice of watching your thinking and letting go of your thinking and not going for periods where you don't talk. Which is why I continue to have more and more retreat time here. And all of us together, and I'm encouraged by more people coming. We had enough people that I talked to the schedulers, and we had already decided we're going to do more retreats next year, have more retreat days. So that's wonderful. Because we get dull through our talking and thinking, and that's just very simple. And when I was young, I would put little sayings on the refrigerator, sayings from my teacher, Suzuki Roshi, that would inspire me. And they'd inspire me for maybe a week. And then I just sort of not even notice them after a week. I say, well, I have to put it someplace else. I put it by the sink. I'd do that for a few days, and then I wouldn't notice it. So that's the way our mind is. That's because we're so dominated by this incessant chatterbox cafe that we spend so much of our time in. And then the teachings no longer really speak to us. They no longer really help us. And of course, Suzuki Roshi, my first teacher, talks about beginner's mind. When we begin, usually we start freshly. Usually we start our first few minutes of meditation, we're really paying attention. Our first day of a retreat, our half day, we're really trying to pay attention at least. But then we lose it. We lose it. And that's a hazard, too, of any kind of role that we settle into. Settle into the role of a student. Settle into the role of a teacher. And it becomes just something we do, just going through the motions. And we need to refresh that by doing practice, by doing some kind of Zen practice. Call it Zen practice or don't call it Zen practice. But that's the way to refresh ourselves. And then we don't need to always be building a nest and hanging out on this nest. And there's an analogy to music that I like a lot. Music, we like live music. We like to go to a concert. I mean, we'll listen to tapes a lot, but it's the concert. It's the when we really feel a connection, usually, because it's alive. And that's what Zen practice is about, is coming alive. So you can just be with whatever and just enjoy it, just deeply appreciate it. I've talked before, but I probably haven't talked maybe for a year or 2 years about, but many of you have heard it, the concert that we had in San Francisco many years ago to raise money for the Country Zen Center that we were developing. And we had, this was many, many years ago, you guys. We had Big Brother and the Holding Company and the Grateful Dead, and we had Janis Joplin come sing at the, I think it was the Fillmore Auditorium, whatever, in San Francisco, where I'm from. And this was in 1967. Probably 1967. So this was sort of when the Haight-Ashbury was just starting to take off, and so this was a huge rock concert. It was huge, and there were all kind of aromas in the air, and light shows going on, and I'd probably only been to one or two of them because I was a good little Zen student. I mean, not that I minded them, but you know, I was more into doing my Zen practice. But since this was for us, we had to come, and Suzuki Roshi was sat in the front row. And Katagiri Roshi was wandered around the outside. He was a young monk, and he just looked totally freaked out. Totally freaked out. What is going on here? But Suzuki Roshi was sitting, the older teacher, my first teacher, sitting in the front row, just very still the whole time. People were dancing, and, you know, well, you know, most of you know about this stuff. And Janis Joplin got up to sing. And most of you, even though it's been a long time, most of you know Janis Joplin, right? So you know, when Janis Joplin sings, she sings. Talk about alive. Talk about alive. And there she, and Suzuki Roshi was in the front row right below her. This little man, 4'11", with bald head and these very meticulous, precisely sewn and ironed robes, all this stuff going around, and him just sitting there, and then her singing. And so she finished her singing, And then it was time for him to get up because it was a Zen, it was a benefit for Zen Center. So they asked him to come, say something, come to the mic. They had to lower the mic for him. And he said, he said something like, he didn't talk much, but and this is all I remember him saying. I remember him saying, "At first I thought your way was very different from ours." And he was paused, and he said, "But now I see not very different." and the crowd all cheered. But you know what he meant by that, don't you? Do you know what he meant by that? That when he saw her, when he saw how she poured her heart out, how she was so available, no censoring, no editing, speaking from her, crying from her heart, he thought, wow. And he was really touched. He was really touched. No cliche there, huh? No cliche there. And that time I worked as a mail handler in the San Francisco post office with a bunch of other counterculture people. And I had not heard Janis Joplin before, but the day before I heard them talking, they said, she's going to be speaking at the Fillmore for the Zen thing. And I just was quiet. I didn't say anything. But when they actually talked about her singing, they got alive. And these guys were really dead. I mean, they were stoned or dead all the time. They were hanging out in the bathroom every time that they, in the San Francisco post office, you could spend a lot of time in the bathroom. So I felt that way with my first two teachers, that just being with them, they brought me alive. Just with them, just by being who they were. Just by not living in the Chatterbox Cafe, but living in this world right here. Just right here. So, in Zen, sometimes our practice seems alive. Sometimes it seems kind of dead. We get tired of sitting. It doesn't work very well. The same conversations go over and over again. And sometimes it's helpful, and sometimes it's not helpful to hear someone, to hear me, to practice. And you just have to stick with it. You have to believe the promise of Buddha, the promise of a Zhaozhou. Zhaozhou's promise was no thingness. No thingness. That we can all manifest. We all already are manifesting it, but we can tap into it anytime we put aside our chattering, or anytime we see through our chattering. So we have our own cliches. I don't know what your cliche, but anything can turn into a cliche, and then we need to have some need to think about it differently, express it differently, and because it's not really helping us. We have a lot of people talk in Zen about deepening practice. I'm deepening my practice. His practice is deeper than mine. I'm gonna, if I do such and such, I'll deepen my practice. So at first it sounds good, but after a while it's just a cliche. I mean, who's this I, and what's this deep, and what's this practice? I mean, what is this? Deeper? Deeper than what? Deeper than just being here? Practice? And is that in contrast to performance? Is that contrast to being? So they become just stuff we talk about, and we got a new character in the Chatterbox Cafe. I'm going to deepen my practice character. Oh, hi. Nice to see you. Okay. Welcome to the group. So he says, isn't this a cliche for people of these times? It has been 5 years, and I still don't know, says the teacher. So the teacher doesn't know. I mean, how many times can I talk about the Chatterbox Cafe before you'll just tune out, and then I got to think of something else to inspire you a little bit or get you to focus a little bit? Can I say it for 5 years, like Joshua did, over and over again? Or will you get so dull, you get, oh, I'm going over there. I want something fresh. I want something. Maybe I've done enough. I talk about it all week. Some of you think, God, he talked about this all week. So I don't know. I just have to try, pull stuff. Let's see what comes up. See if it will wake you up. See if it'll make you look a little more attentive and wanna fulfill the promise of discovering and manifesting that no thingness that's present in moment to moment, nonstop flow, that calmness, that fluidity, that joy. And then he could be saying, I don't know, in that kind of way, or he could be doing the profound Zen, I don't know, which is, I don't know. That is, I don't know. There's no hindrance, there's no definition, there's nothing in particular, it's just the big I don't know. And when there's the big I don't know, we don't get caught by our chattering mind, because we're just looking at it, just being with it, just listening to it. And with a big I don't know, we don't get stuck in virtual reality. Virtual reality comes along, but we don't get stuck in it. So during retreat, I was also talking about my first awakening. And you know, if you go back to your childhood, you can find lots of awakenings, lots of times. Most of us, when as a child or adolescent, you just were there with something. You were just moved, and you were still, and you just saw. Or maybe you can just find one or two times, or maybe not very many. But the time that I was talking about in retreat was a time that I was at, on the West Coast with my sister in the tidal pools of Half Moon Bay, and I saw her touch the sea anemone. And we always played around in the tidal pools. The sea anemones always stayed closed. And we never got to see them. And I used to poke them with sticks, but it didn't help. And I was something like 11, and my sister was something like 9, and she just went over and just very gently touched one of them, and it completely opened. And I looked into it, and the inside of a sea anemone is like a beautiful flower, only it's moving. It's a moving flower. And I was just overwhelmed with wonder and joy, and something I really remember from my childhood. And after that, although my sister was younger, I would follow her to see how she did this. I would never let her know, because I didn't want my younger sister to know that I was needing to learn from her how just to be touch something softly and let it open. And see it. So when I used to have trouble in retreats years ago, I would bring that image up. I would bring that image up of just touching and letting go, not poking, because it just but touching and letting go. Lots of times in our meditation when it's not going well, we're poking. We're saying, God damn it, you know, poke, 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 and then what happens? Close up. Close up. And I needed to do that during retreats, during these sessions, 2 days or 7 days, for those of you who haven't done them, they're very strenuous. very strenuous. I needed to do them because I had these, and I'm being a little facetious here, but these dumb Japanese teachers who would never give me any meditation instruction. And, you know, any time you would ask for technique, they would say, well, what do you want to get with your technique? You know, just sit. And that made it especially hard. So I had to draw on my emotional memory to just stay. So now I want to finish by talking about the verse. The verse is by Setcho. The verse is written later. It's an addendum to the case. The verse, Setcho says, "The elephant king yawns, the lion roars. Flavorless talk blocks off people's mouths. South, north, east, west, the golden crow swoops, the silver hair bounds." So the elephant yawns, the lion roars, flavorless talk blocks off people's mouths. So Zhaozhou here is both the roaring of the lion and the yawning of the elephant. So he's being praised for his ability to use words in a way that really provokes people, that has a roar, that really opens them into the Dharma, the roaring rapids of the Dharma, but also for being still and simple, and just yawning, and just eating, and just sleeping. So there's a Hasidic story about a young man who wants to learn the wisdom of the ancients. And he goes to his friends, who he really respects, and he said, well, the way to find a Hasidic teacher who will really, really help you and really engage you and really open you to your own wisdom is to spend time with him and see how he ties his shoelaces. That's very much could be a Zen story, because it's the simplicity of just being with that this Zen practice is all about. And more and more as we do this, we can just do that and be with it and be engaged in it and not make a huge deal out of it. On this part about the golden crow swoops, the silver hair hounds, this is from Chinese mythology. And people thought that spots on the sun were a mysterious three-legged crow and believed that a silver hare lived in the moon. Then they evolved to mean the sun and the moon, these two symbols, and then they just evolved to mean just light. So really all he's saying is that the light that emanates from Zhaozhou's being and his words is helpful. That's what he's saying. That's all he's saying. So I felt with my teachers that their lightness often wasn't what they said so much as their lightness, the way they were, when they tied their shoelaces, when they untied their shoelaces, when they got knots in their shoelaces. It was their ability to be light without it, to live lightly, that was most helpful to me. So I think I want to finish, and I think it's probably a shorter talk than I sometimes give, but that's okay. I want to finish with a poem by Mary Oliver, part of a poem, which really, I think, is about what I've been talking about. Who made the world? Who made the swan and the black bear? Who made the grasshopper? This grasshopper, I mean. The one who has flung herself out of the grass, the one who is eating sugar out of my hand, who is moving her jaws back and forth instead of up and down, who is gazing around with her enormous and complicated eyes. Now she lifts her pale forearms and thoroughly washes her face. Now she snaps her wings open and floats away. I don't know exactly what a prayer is. I don't know how to pay attention, how to fall down into the grass, how to kneel down in the grass, how to be idle and blessed, how to stroll through the fields, which is what I have been doing all day. Tell me, what else should I have done? Doesn't everything die at last and too soon? Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? So that's a little Mary Oliver Zen. Your one wild and precious life. Very precious. As I was saying last time, Suzuki Roshi said, our lives are as precious as what? As dirt on our fingernails. Doesn't sound very precious, but it really is. Our lives are short, and we can enjoy the grasshoppers and the snow, or we can hang out all our lives in the Chatterbox Cafe. We really can't do both. It's really not possible to do both. So I think that's what I want to say for this morning. Questions? Comments? Anybody have any questions or comments?
Are you saying that we should give up all attempts to attain things or to accomplish things?
I think that in regard to meditation, you should do that. But not in regard to your life outside meditation. You need to have goals. Meditation, your goal should only be to meditate.
You were talking about the deeper practice.
The deep practice, you still need to have... Yeah, deep practice, we have goals. Goals are great. The problem is that we spend so much of our time focusing on when are we going to get to the goal, what's the goal going to look like, why aren't we making enough progress, that we're not doing the activity to get there. And of course we need goals. Of course we need goals. In a way, when I say there's a promise that Zhaozhou makes to you, that you can manifest no thing, that you can manifest stillness, that's a goal. A promise is a goal. But it's only by the activity itself, without the measuring, without the comparing, that the goal will really come organically into your life, whether it's meditation or not. Don't you think? Pardon?
It's like walking on a tightrope.
You're right. You're right. But see, most people are always falling off the tightrope. They're not walking on it because they just get fixated on this goal, you know, in comparison to what it should have been, what it might be, what someone else is doing. And we're always comparing. And when we do that, we're not really doing the practice. So when I have a job that requires a lot of planning, my other job. This job actually doesn't require much planning, which is wonderful, except my talks, but I have another job that requires a lot of planning. So when it's time for me to plan, I try to just give my whole focus just to planning. Just to planning, and that's my practice. Rather than planning when I'm driving or planning when I'm eating or does that make sense?
Yeah.
And it is a tightrope, and we are always falling off. We're always falling off. Huh?
Yeah, it's a tough balance because if there's no effort at all, you can just be sitting in a mental hospital.
Yeah, or any place. Interesting. Anybody else?
Something that I've been thinking about lately, and I'm sure it'll become a cliche real soon. This is only the last couple of days. I've been thinking about, instead of goals, to have trust. And stop having goals. And just trust that, and keep practicing
Yeah. And of course, in Zen practice, that's wonderful. If we can move from the goal to the trust, to the just, that's wonderful. In daily life, we need to have some goals, though. You know, we need to. But even in a daily life, just have some trust. We're going to make our best effort to do whatever our goal is. Maybe to cook a meal once a week for my wife and have her be relatively happy with my cooking. That's my goal. But if I worry about it, I mean, I can't cook like she does. I just do my best to get the ingredients together, to take care of them, to think of what she likes, and just to be there. So, 5 years, 10 years, 110 years, we just do this. Anything else?